From NPR News in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, I'm Neil Conan, and this is Talk of the Nation. On May 1st, in cities across the country, Mexicans stood with Dominicans, Guatemalans with Puerto Ricans, illegal immigrants with first and second generation Latino Americans. It was a remarkable display of unity among Hispanics who trace their origins to many countries and come from varied economic, ethnic, and political backgrounds. Some Hispanic activists declared May Day the start of a broad Hispanic movement and the beginning of a powerful pan-Latino coalition. Other Hispanics beg to differ. They point to internal disagreements over the intent of the immigration protests themselves and also about the immigration issue itself. Opinion polls show Hispanics divided on issues from abortion and bilingual classrooms to the war in Iraq. A special broadcast today from the annual conference of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists Convention this year at the Broward County Convention Center in Fort Lauderdale. Is Pan-Latino Coalition possible, desirable, under whose leadership, under whose agenda? Later in the program, Chicago Radio's El Pistolero, Rafael Pulido, joins us to talk about the power of Spanish language radio. But first, if you have questions about what unifies and what divides Hispanics, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. We'll also be taking questions from the audience here in Fort Lauderdale. And we're going to hear a couple of viewpoints as well. Joining us first is Ilan Stavanz, a professor of Latin American and Latino culture at Amherst College, the author of several books, including The Hispanic Condition, The Power of a People. He's with us here in Fort Lauderdale, and thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Let's start with those immigration marches. Were these isolated events, or is this the start of something big?
I think that on May 1st, we finally, those 44 million Latinos became Latinos. We had been Puerto Ricans, we had been Mexicans, we had been Cubans. But on that day, fateful day, we created some sort of umbrella coalition, some sort of unity, a unity that is based on multiplicity. It's a fractured, challenging, divergent unity that points to how we have lived our history together and the challenge of can we have a future that is together.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, I think that the approach that we have had up until May 1st was that we were Mexican Americans and that we had our own civil rights movement, the Chicano movement, and that we were Puerto Ricans and the Puerto Rican young lords participated during the civil rights era and the Cubans during the exile from Castro's regime. But on that very important day, we all went out. The challenge, as you said at the beginning of the show, is that we don't yet have a face. We don't have a leader. And not until we have one will we be able to have a voice, a single voice.
Mm-hmm. But is a single voice possible? I mean, you, for example, your background, you're both Mexican-American and Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
Do you identify with Guatemalans or with Puerto Ricans?
Well, of course. I am Mexican the way somebody can be Guatemalan. I'm Jewish the way somebody can be Protestant. But we all speak Spanish. We all come from the same geographical background. And when we have a vote and when we connect with certain issues, those issues and that vote erases in many ways the background and the national mm-hmm. perspective that we have. But having a single voice is not erasing differences, is bringing them together. And
yet, who gets to pick, when you say those issues, what issues? As we said, all those opinion polls show a lot of different opinions.
That is the beauty of the Latino community, that we are not one single block, that we have conservatives and liberals, that we have young and old, white, black, and mestizo. And if we all had a single way of thinking, I think it would be quite dangerous. It would be a Soviet approach to ethnicity.
All right. Well, let's bring another voice into the conversation. Miriam Marquez, immigration editor for the Miami Herald, also with us here in Fort Lauderdale. We appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you.
Florida is a very specific case. I mean, we tend to think of, again, the big immigrant communities in Texas, in California, places like New Mexico, of course. But here in Florida, you begin to see a much more diverse Hispanic community.
Much more diverse, and in South Florida, in Miami in particular, half of our population now is non-Cuban Hispanic,
mm-hmm.
Of that 60%. And what we see as far as the driving force of these marches were the Mexican-American community. And we're only at 5% of our community in South Florida is Mexican-American. So when the rest of the nation had 500,000 people out there marching on May Day, when everyone was marching, we had at tops 20,000 and scattered in three or four different events that day. We had Cuban-Americans joining them, definitely, but it wasn't a hue and cry, and they weren't going out there. We had specific Cuban-American leaders coming out and trying to do a campaign to encourage unity, which was interesting because there's been a lot of infighting in the past about the immigration, because Cubans have a different immigration question.
And sure.
They don't have to battle like the Mexicans or others coming in because
other communities don't have the wet foot, dry foot
exactly,
issue.
Exactly, yes. Exactly. So that was definitely different. And then I think there was the whole old school, old guard, older, more conservative versus the younger folks, more progressive. There was also a divide there looking at, Americans in other places that were non-Hispanic were saying, oh, they're flying the Mexican flag. Well, in Cuban Miami, they were saying, oh, they're wearing Che Guevara T-shirts, and don't you know that he ran the firing squads in Havana?
Mm-hmm.
And I think those sorts of sub-layers made a big difference here.
But was there a sense of electricity at all those Latino faces on TV gathered in one place making a statement?
Oh, I definitely. You had the Cuban American National Foundation leader coming out and running ads trying to encourage people to come out. So they were trying to build some sort of coalition. But the hue and cry for most people, frankly, it was very different. Lake Worth ended up being one of the places in Palm Beach County that had the most people marching. It's a predominantly Mexican community, and I think that's what we have. A lot of struggling people, the Hondurans, the Guatemalans, they were all trying to find a voice. We had another sub-layer, which was our Caribbean community, Haitians. Mm-hmm. They were not part of the march, even though they had the information. Their leaders were trying to get people out to march, but they saw it as a Hispanic, a Latino thing.
Mm-hmm. There are great divisions in class as well.
Absolutely.
And did the wealthier people, say, from South America see this as a poor Mexican issue?
Yes, I think the Argentinians who are here, a lot of them were like, well, our status is sort of questionable right now, but that's not us.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, again, just a layering of different socioeconomic as well as the reasons why they're here.
Mm-hmm. Let's bring another voice into this. This is Ruben Navarrete, a columnist for the San Diego Union-Tribune, and nice of you to be with us here in Fort Lauderdale as well.
Thank you, Neil.
And I want to ask you the same question I began to Professor Stavins, and that is, what's your reaction to the immigration debate? Was this a moment, the start of something big?
I think it is a start of something big, and I think the reason is that if this were merely a debate about borders and security and legal versus illegal, if that was really the extent of it, then you'd have a different dynamic at work. But this has really quickly become an assault on culture and language. This has really become anti-Mexican, anti-Latino. I offer as Exhibit A the fact that we were having a debate in Congress over immigration, and all of a sudden I read in the paper where the senators got together and declared English the national language of the United States. That's interesting to me, because one minute we're talking about immigration, suddenly we're talking about language. And I think it was also helpful because once that happens, it does bring together Latinos from different vantage points who have different immigration stories.
Mm-hmm.
I can get together 100 different Latinos from different countries, and on immigration they may differ, but they all speak Spanish. And so they are all deeply offended by this notion that somehow there needs to be this declaration whereby English is the national language. And so that was kind of a very helpful thing. The Senate actually was helpful because it, to my mind, lifted the veil on what this is really all about in the first place. This is about the fact that all over the United States, Main Street is turning into Little Mexico. This is about the fact that people have to push one for English and two for Spanish. This is about the changes that are sweeping across America and a really determined sense that Americans have that they want to fight it. They want to go back to the old days. And to that degree, that is having a unifying effect and bringing together very different kinds of Latinos because they see this for what it is. This is an assault on Latino culture and language.
Mm-hmm. Yet it's one thing to have this sort of nationalist response when you're against something. People can unite on that, as you say. Gets a little bit more difficult than you say, well, then what are we for?
Right. No, that is complicated. Americans have the same problem, not just with this debate, but with so many others we could mention. We typically say, well, I'm against this, I'm against that. Let's reform the Social Security system. Anything I throw out there, raising the retirement age, I'm against that. But when you start asking, well, what are you for? Well, it goes silent.
Mm-hmm.
It's an American phenomenon. We are so much better at criticizing things that we don't like than actually being proactive and saying, hey, this is what I really like out here. So, again, this is sort of a it's very much part of the American culture, as I said before, bringing these people together. But to my mind, the striking part of it is that this if this was ever about anything but language and culture, the veil is lifted now. We know that it isn't anymore. And that is having, again, this sort of unifying effect.
Professor Stavans, I wonder what you think.
I think that's May 1st was more than about immigration. I think it was about citizenship. It was about how do we define America and Americans, a passport-carrying citizen, after September 11. It was about terrorism. It was about who is in and who is out. And it was about the borders. How do we look at the South? What is happening in Venezuela and in Bolivia? I think that the sense that the United States is being Hispanicized, that it's being transformed, that the message of the founding fathers is being put aside, that another language is coming to the fore, and that another face, another citizenship, is transforming the original principles.
Yeah, we saw
a lot
of those same responses when the Irish came, when the Italians came. How is this different?
Oh, it's very similar. I think that when the Jews came, when the Irish came, they were always perceived as being a threat. They were described as bringing viruses and epidemics. They were described as not using the language in the proper way. And eventually they move up in the social and economic scale, and they acquire power. And that what we're seeing now is a process of transformation in which Latinos are slowly climbing up, or you might describe it as a transition from the periphery of culture to the center, and it's about power. It's about how the country will define itself in the future.
We're going to have to take a short break, and when we come back, we'd like to get your calls on what divides and what unites Hispanics across the country. Do you see yourself, if you're Hispanic, as Mexican-American, Guatemalan-American, as Puerto Rican, as, Salvadoran, or do you see yourself as Latino? How have things changed since the marches this spring? 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We're going to be back after a short break. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Pro-immigration rallies this spring united Hispanics across the country. Some activists declared it the start of a new and united political front. Others disagree. We're talking about what brings Latinos together and what divides. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Our guests are Ilan Stavans, a professor of Latin American Studies and Latino Culture at Amherst College, Miriam Marquez, who's immigration editor for the Miami Herald, and Ruben Navarreta, a syndicated opinion columnist whose column originates at the San Diego Union-Tribune. Of course, 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. And we have a question from the audience.
Hi, Neil. I'm Ray Suarez. I'm a member of the NAHJ and a longtime fan of Talk of the Nation.
And a longtime host of Talk of the Nation as well.
And I'm glad you're doing this topic because this has been a question, a sort of perennial question, and it got to be a boring question after a while, the Latino unity question. Mm-hmm. But enough stuff changed to make it a really exciting and interesting question again. And I think a lot of it has to do with generational differences. A lot of it has to do with the gradual loosening of the glue that holds you to your native country as you're more generations in the country. Some of that unity came from being the, you guys all go together and stand over there thing. I mean, a Mexican, I'm Puerto Rican, I grew up in New York, and I didn't think I had anything in common with Mexicans, and for a long time I didn't. But the longer you're not in those places, and the more cities in America that now aren't dominated by just one Latino ethnic group, young people don't make those same distinctions. My kids' generation doesn't make that same distinctions. They don't. And then a commercial world of magazines called Latino Style and Latina and all that, they don't make those distinctions. So after a while, you don't make those distinctions either. And you actually find out they're not that important as your parents thought they were. So I'd be interested to hear from the panel what they think about generational change, and also the fact that as we're obsessing about foreign-born Latinos, a large proportion of the population currently in the United States is native-born, and whether being in America has a transformative impact on their answer to this question about unity.
Ruben Navarrete, why don't we begin with you?
Well, I think on the generational angle, I think Ray's absolutely right. My friend Ray is absolutely right. There is this phenomenon that takes place over time because we're talking about Hispanic this and Latino that, and all of a sudden people don't make the distinctions. It used to be a really big deal, and there used to be a lot of space between the Cuban experience and the Puerto Rican experience and the Mexican experience. And Ray's right, we could talk about this, and it typically was kind of a dead-end subject, you know. But then you get folks who come along who are xenophobic, who are nativist, who are racist in some cases, and who are advocating a real sort of push for homogeneity because they are concerned that there's too much Latino going on. You know, suddenly it's hip to be Hispanic and it's great to be Latino, and people are wondering, well, what does that mean for me? I'm just a white male from Minnesota. You know, where am I going to fit into all this? Well, as that occurs, I think young people are part of that wave coming in, and I think they become more comfortable with it, just like they become more comfortable with gay marriage and other things that grandma and grandpa don't really understand or approve of. I think it's okay with kids. I think it means something. Also, I think one other thing, I thought about this when Ray was talking. As we become more Americanized, and every generation becomes more, quote, Americanized, one of the great things about that is that this is, at the end of the day, a wonderful and compassionate and fair-minded country. And so we know how to recognize the situation where the little guy's getting picked on. And whenever I defend the little guy, I'm not speaking as a Mexican-American. I'm speaking as an American. That's what Americans do. We go around the world, defend the little guy. And so to that end, when you have this young kid and he sees this debate for the ugliness, in the ugliness that it is, part of that is being an American after so many generations and saying, hey, you know what? I've seen this movie before, and, you know, it ends badly.
Mm-hmm. Miriam Marquez, do you see that that kind of galvanization here in Miami?
I think you're right. Generationally, it was a conversation I was having with the reporters during the coverage of this, that generationally you were finding young people are not as hung up about, you know, Che Guevara, for instance. Mm-hmm. That became, again, a big thing. So, yeah, absolutely. It makes a huge difference. But also, I think that there is the issue of class. You know, the more educated we are, we are much broader thinking. And I think that also changes our view. We're more into the pan-Hispanic outlook because we view... We can see the similarities in our home countries or in our parents' home countries, and what occurred, what caused migration, what were the things that you almost see history repeating itself in a lot of ways, and we learn from that, and we share a lot of things. So, yes, it absolutely makes a difference. And in Miami, you're seeing that difference. It's growing just by leaps.
Ilan Stavon?
I want to put a word of caution here. It is true that I became a Latino because of my students and because of my children. I was a Mexican until they told me that I was a Latino because they are Latinos. But we have to remember that we Latinos have been in this country for more than 150 years and that there has always been a mix between the native-born and the outside-born. And that as long as new generations keep on coming, there's always going to be this tension between the here I've been for quite a while and the you are just arriving and you're looking at things differently. Since the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848 to the successive wars of annexation and colonization, Latinos have made it to this country either willingly or unwillingly, and the tension between those that are second and third generation and those that just arrived yesterday doesn't disappear.
And of course, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo annexed much of what used to be Mexico to what is now the southwestern United States. Anyway, let's get a caller on the line. This is Maria. Maria calling from San Jose in California.
Yes, hi. I just want to give my 5 cents on the term American and operationalize it a little different. I am a Venezuelan. I was born in Venezuela. I've been here for 30 years. But since birth, we always see ourselves as Americans. And I challenge my students, because I teach, I challenge my students to think of a scripture, a noun for their nationality here. And they always say Americans. We Latinos see ourselves as Americans, have always done that. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about becoming American or being American, our Venezuelan identity, our Guatemalan identity is there. It has been there all along. So my students call themselves United Stadiums. And I just want to put that little bit in there, because when I hear this American, and we have always been American.
Do you see it? Thank you very much for that, Maria. Do you see the country as that inclusive, Ruben Navarrete?
No, I don't see it inclusive. We I have two kids here, and of course they use the term United Stadiums because they're with their mother's cause, but no, when I always challenge my students and say, so what do you think a Canadian is? What do you think a Mexican is, if not an American?
All right.
Yeah, this is one of those debates we're never going to resolve, and I have it in my household because my wife is Mexican-born, and every time I say the Americans, she gets mad. You know, we're Americans too. It's true, okay? North, South, and Central America. But in the context, in the vernacular of the United States, we typically refer to ourselves as Americans, and that is something our Latin American friends are never going to forgive us for.
All right. Maria, thanks very much for the call. Let's get another question from the audience here in Fort Lauderdale.
Hi, my name is Alina. I'm a journalist here in South Florida, and I'm attending this conference. My question is, initially when we first began this debate, what we saw on television were images of marches, rallies, and people wrapping themselves in a Mexican flag or the flag of their own country. And that was, you know, certainly in my place of work and in my community by Americans, that was taken as so offensive. You know, you want to be American, why are you waving the flag of another country? How would that look if we did the same thing elsewhere? So my question to the panel is, you know, we saw an immediate tempering we saw people, you know, beginning to carry the flags and marches, the American flag. And so do you think that sort of tempering of that rhetoric within Latino groups was a positive thing for the debate or not? Was it a positive thing for all Latinos or not?
Mm-hmm. And let me extend that and say, should this be a Spanish language debate or an English language debate or a bilingual debate? Professor Stavins.
Well, if I can use the issue of language and take it one step further, when the debate took place about the Star-Spangled Banner being in Spanish, mm-hmm. and President Bush came out saying that it shouldn't be done, that this is in English, it was quickly forgotten that other immigrant groups have done exactly the same. The Star-Spangled Banner has been in Yiddish, it has been in Finnish, it has been in Polish, it has been in Russian. All these other groups have found a way to use their own language to express their passion for the United States. They are not translating the Mexican anthem into English. They are translating the American anthem into Spanish as a form of loyalty. The same thing happens with the flag. I think it has to do with a sense of loyalty. We are not like the Poles. We are not like the Irish in that our own country is just next door. Our flag has been in this country too, with the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, with the Spanish-American War, and it is intertwined. It is mixed into the mm-hmm. texture, into the mosaic that is America, and I think that separating them doesn't quite take us far enough.
Miriam Marquez?
The question is, was this a better strategy? I think it was definitely a strategy. I don't know that people really felt it. In other words, there were activists saying, all right, let's pull back from those earlier marches and let's try not to use the you had people like Senator Mel Martinez of Florida coming out publicly and saying, you know, we're not doing our cause any good. He's trying to work it in Washington and get some reform and some kind of immigration bill if we start to do this with the flag. But to me, it was the language of the heart. It was indeed nothing. There was no ill will. People were doing it, same with the translation of the anthem, as something that came spontaneously, trying to reach out to other mm-hmm. others who are not immigrants, but were in some lifetime. So no,
all of us were immigrants at some point.
It was all strategy. I don't know how. I don't think it changed any minds. People who were against, who want to close the borders, don't care. If you could have had 1,000 U.S. flags waving there, they'd still have a complaint. I just don't think it would have mattered for those who had already staked
I see you nodding, aside. Ruben Navarrete.
I do agree completely with Miriam. I think that there, and I get, you know, the column's in a lot of papers, and I get 500 or so emails a week where I do an impersonation of a piñata because everybody's coming at me with bats and stuff. And a lot of it regarding the flags and the protests were sort of along the lines of, Well, look, we saw your true intentions. We know that you really want to wave the Mexican flag, but now you're just trying to be shrewd and manipulative mm-hmm. by waving the American flag. And so Miriam's right. For folks who want to close the border and who think there's an invasion coming in from Mexico, they don't really care what you're waving. They know that you're the problem in their minds. I also want to just quibble with President Bush's criticism of the national anthem. This is the same president who goes around the country speaking Spanish, who more than any president in recent memory has made an outreach effort in Spanish, who has Spanish language websites, who puts out press releases in Spanish. This is Se Habla Español president. It was hypocritical of him to take issue with merely the translating of the national anthem into Spanish when he himself has brought Spanish into the public realm more than any president in recent memory.
We're talking about the unifying and divisive factors amongst Latinos, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's talk about some divisive factors. Do we talk about race in the Latino community? Why not? Why do we see so few Afro-Latinos in amongst the leadership and in the Spanish-speaking media?
What leadership? I'll begin. The big question of the May 1st marches was about the lack of leadership. Was it a movement? I doubt it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a massive demonstration, but it did not have one or two figures, names, faces that were able to lead us. And I think the reason why has to do with class, has to do with nationality, and it has to do with race. We can be Latinos on Univision. We can be Latinos in a panel like this pretending that we will erase differences. Can we all galvanize our emotions and our political power behind a single figure? I don't think so, because that figure would have to be a Mexican-American and Cubans won't do it, or a Cuban-American and Puerto Ricans won't do it. We cannot yet forget that we're coming from different parts of Latin America, and that those different parts have to do with the color of our skin, being white, Caucasian, being a Afro-Cuban or Afro-Caribbean, being mestizo, still pretty much defines where in the social hierarchy, in the economic hierarchy, you are as a Latino. The whiter you are, the higher you are in Latino society, pretty much the way it happens in Latin America.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that this is a continuing problem, Ruben Navarrete?
I'd say that it's very much something that's with us and will be with us, you're right, for a while, because Elon's absolutely right. To pick one person, to have one person who could somehow everybody would be able to identify with would be very difficult. But one thing that's an interesting angle to this is Ray Suarez's point from earlier, the fact that as people begin to define themselves as Latino, when I hear that the heavyweight champion of the world is Hispanic, you know, I don't really care that he's not Mexican-American. It's broad enough as it's defined Hispanic or Latino. When I look at people like Chiquita, you have Latinos, Mexican-Americans who are listening. She's from Colombia. It doesn't really matter. In that respect, because the concept of Hispanic and Latino has become so broad, I think it allows you to identify with people in ways you couldn't have imagined you would have.
Yeah, but it has to be a boxer or it has to be a musician. It can be a politician.
Okay. Let me ask one more question before we let this go, and that is about political identification. Cuban-American community here in Miami has been very heavily Republican. Elsewhere in the country, to be Latino, does it mean to be Latino you have to be a Democrat?
In California, it does, typically. And the reason is Republicans have done such a clumsy job there of playing with this dynamite. They're doing it again. And they've sort of made their decision that they want to go after disaffected white voters and that nativism is the way to get there, and the end result is you turn off Latinos. But with Mexican-Americans, there's sort of this jump ball. They're not predictably Democratic like Puerto Ricans. They're not predictably Republican like Cuban. They are people who register Democrats but will, on occasion, vote for a Republican. Arnold Schwarzenegger, Richard Reardon, George Bush, as a matter of fact, in Texas. So there are John McCain in Arizona.
Are they going to do it again?
For Bush, yeah. I think that they see Bush as the good guy in this. He's taking a heck of a beating from his own party over the immigration issue. But I think that they may continue to pick and choose. If Arnold is able to differentiate himself and say, listen, you know, I'm not with those crazy guys in the Congress. I'm in California, and I'm with you. I'm pro-immigrant. He might not get splattered with that.
Yeah. Miriam Marquez, I'm going to give you the last 30 seconds.
I think the political question is again, there's so many layers to this. Cubans themselves, 40-some percent voted for Bill Clinton second time around when he ran because the GOP Congress at that time was trying to ram through these anti-immigrant bills that would have hurt Abuelita with her Social Security if she wasn't a U.S. citizen. So, yeah, you know, there's a lot, there's people vote their pocketbook, and they also vote depending on their nationality, maybe perhaps a little bit about geopolitical questions such as Castro or free trade.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you all very much for being with us. Ilan Stavins at Amherst University, also Miriam Marquez of the Miami Herald, and Ruben Navarrete, syndicated columnist. We appreciate your time today. This is NPR News.